Hello and welcome to a special edition of the In the Money Players Podcast. This is our show dropping Tuesday, January 18th, brought to us by our friends at Kentucky Downs. Going to be chatting about a couple of more evergreen type topics that our friends over there wanted to get discussion out in the world about. And we're going to kick on the show with me, Peter Thomas Fornital, your host in the Brooklyn Bunker, and a man coming to us who you've heard on these airwaves before, giving out winners. You've heard him on the At the Races, not the UK At the Races that I do writing for, but the USA At the Races with Steve Bick, one of my favorite radio programs. I'm speaking of the Hammer, Rick Hammerly. Hammer, how are you doing, my man?
You know what? Not too bad. And doing better since I'm talking to you.
We love to hear that. We're going to talk to you about your role on the Graded Stakes Committee. I'm super curious about this myself, learning a little bit how the sausage is made, how certain races get upgraded, downgraded, how that whole process works. But before we get to that, I just wanted to ask you generally about your Kentucky Downs experience this year. You guys tried a bunch of new things. From my observations from afar, a lot of it worked out well, especially on the contest front. But I wanted to ask you about your experience and your role there for those that don't know.
Well, Kentucky Downs, what a, you know, I tell you, I'm Kentucky Downs is a great meet. It's in early September usually and runs for anywhere from 5 to 6 days, but that could stretch either, you know, into 2 weeks, which is a great time of the year for that. Currently, I'm in Hot Springs, Arkansas at Oakland Park. So I'm still living in California. So I only take jobs that are 2,000 miles away. So I don't want to be too close to home, but no, Kentucky Downs is, you know, what is very, cool about Kentucky Downs and the whole experience there, at least for me. Ted Nicholson, who is the general manager there, and Ted and I went to school together, and when I became unemployed a few years ago, he was one of the first people to call me and say, "Hey, why don't you come work Kentucky Downs?" And I said, "Yeah, all right. You know, what do you want me to do?" And he said, "Don't worry about it. Just show up." So, And so what's kind of happened is working with Tyler Picklesheimer, who's the racing secretary in the racing office, and Ted, who kind of runs the whole deal there, formed kind of a little mini management team that just gets things done. And what's so neat about it is you get there about a week before the meet. And remember, this place runs, you know, 10 days a year. So the grass course is kept in condition, and, you know, the area is – you know, has a few weeds growing up, let's say, around it, and the barn area is empty, and the racing office hasn't been open for 350 days. So you really start from the very beginning, the basics, you know, getting things done. The crew there is fantastic. So getting the grandstand ready, getting the little mini stand there that is the announcer's booth, getting the video ready, and just getting ready for the meet in the paddock, seeing it grow up. And from the 3 years that I've been there, it's really gone from a, hey, you know, bring your ice chest and sit on the side of the hill and watch the pretty horses go around the field, which is still great, into a super meet where everybody wants to show up. And when I say everybody, I mean the owners are there, the trainers are there, the fans come, and the ownership has done a great job of growing along with the sport that has happened there at Kentucky Downs, meaning we now have a semi-permanent clubhouse, you know, big tent, Breeders' Cup-like facility, and, you know, new tote boards, new video equipment. So it's stepped up the game to the level of the purses and the horses that run there. So you got to see the meet grow, you experience it, and then you kind of shut her down on the way out. So it's been a really fulfilling experience, to tell you the truth.
Definitely unique facility, Kentucky Downs. And you talked about the people who are attracted to come there. Contest players are among that number. I had spoken to Ted on phone calls in the past, but hadn't had a chance to meet him until this year's University of Arizona symposium. Thank you, Hammer, by the way, for your push on getting me out there for the first time, because that was a really enlightening and interesting conference where I got to meet a lot of people, Ted among them. And one of the things he was speaking about was the success that Kentucky Downs has had in the contest arena. I have a feeling that's something you might have been a little bit involved in anyway, behind the scenes, pulling some strings. How did the new contest format, the king of the turf, essentially, contest work out for you guys this year?
Well, it was tremendous. So there, take that. There's just another instance. We had the single day, I believe, the year before, and then this concept came up with, you know, let's have a three-dayer and call it the, you know, the king of the turf. And sat down. I'll tell you, for a 10-day meet, or, you know, a 10-day long meet, we have more pre-phone calls that go into it, which is good, because we plan, everything's, you know, it's planned out. It's not, hey, what are we going to do when we get there? And so the 3-day meet came along. Brian Skirka from Monmouth Park, who is just super with the contest, has all the contacts, you know, helped us with the rules. And I'm, you know, we had a half a dozen phone calls about the rules. Ken Kirshner, rock concert guy. I always say that.
Different Kirshner. That's Kirshner. This is Kirkner, who had a hand. Yeah. It's pretty amazing that there's one dude out there who had a hand in the creation of both the NHC and the BCBC. Well, there is, and it's Ken. And I got to tell you, I'm just sold between what Ken has accomplished in the contest game and the amazing job Brian has done taking those Monmouth contests and making that into a real scene. Anytime you get that brain trust involved along with yourself, this is clearly something that's going to be player friendly and successful.
Right. And we went, you know, over the rules and the pot size and how much to buy in size and the order of the contest, and should they all be the same, or should we have three separate contests? You know, we threw out everything. And of course, the number one consideration is, what would the player want? And then we actually, you know, went out and talked to some players. What a concept. And, right? Hey, let's talk to our players. And
it seems so simple, and you'd be surprised in corners of this game how rare it is. That's the joke for those maybe newer. Oh, there's some grizzled horse player veterans laughing along with us when you say that. Some new people would be like, well, what's so weird about talking to the customer? Like, isn't that what every business does? Well, not always in horse racing, but yes, in this instance.
In this instance. And I have been involved with, you know, those that do and those that don't. And it just blows your mind that, you know, we would, you know, find 10 of them and bring them in a room and, you know, and say, hey, let's go. Let's talk. What do you guys want? But anyway, we did this for the contest. And boy, for year one, you know, you don't set your expectations too high. And you know, Brian gave us a number and what we thought, and we'd be very happy with it. And we were super happy. And I think it's just going to grow and grow. And, you know, we're getting the old wrestling belt to give away there.
I heard a rumor that might be going down at the NHC this year. I'll definitely have to cover that. Just in, hey, it ain't far now. Just like a week and a half till we're out there in Vegas. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's the plan. And you know, we want you to, you know, be all over that too as well. And but yeah, of course, I saw one of these belts sitting at the golf course actually here last year. I took a picture. I said, we got to do this. The winner's got to have a belt. Just to have. Of course, I've been in pushing for you know, winners of contests and winners of grade one races to get some form of, you know, jewelry to have, like the old poker bracelet. So when they're out at dinner, somebody goes, hey, what's that? Hey, that's when I won the grade one Sanity Handicap. You know, I haven't got that done yet, but I'm really for, you know, handing out some swag when people win races that they can, you know, not just have a little put in the trophy case. But anyway, we have a little fun with this, but we want to turn this into, like we said, the turf handicapping champion of the year. And
I love it.
And
this idea, one of the things that contests do so well is celebrating players. And I love your idea for grade one winners as well, because I'll tell you what, celebrating owners, also something that racing in general can probably do a bit more of. It's the owners, it's the players. We put up the money that funds the whole enterprise. So any opportunity to celebrate them and doing it in a creative way like you helped to do at Kentucky Downs, I just absolutely love that. Wanted to get that story in here before we kick on with our chat about the Graded Stakes Committee.
Well, you know, one other thing, you know, when I was at Santa Anita, we gave away some different type of trophies. In fact, you know, we used to give away the surfboards at the Zuma Beach and the Surfer Girl, and renamed those races. And I said, we're giving away surfboards. So we would get, you know, I had a guy that professional surfboard, would make the surfboards. We'd put them down in the paddock all day. And let me tell you, when the winner of that race, I mean, I'd have them displayed in my office all meet, and they would, I mean, then the beginning of the meet, and they would stare at that. And I'll tell you what, I have more people say, I want to win that darn surfboard. And, and when the race would cross the wire, I would literally used to have owners call me up and say, do not give that surfboard to my trainer. You send it home to me. My grandkid's going to want, or something like that. So it came to the point at the end, they wanted duplicates. So my surfboard guy's like, this is great. So we'd order three or four of them. But so we did that. And we, you know, I give away basketballs at March Madness, and we'd have the football. So I said, we were near Nashville. I told Ted, I go, we got to take advantage of this. I go, you got to give away a guitar, man. Come on, let's do it. So the first, he goes, oh, that's all right. So we created the Music City Stakes, and we gave away a guitar a couple years ago. I think they gave away a guitar for every graded race this year with, you know, Reba McEntire. He signed it. So, you know, to me, you know, rather than getting some of these, you know, some owners, they win a lot of races, they get their silver cup and they put it over there. But they'd rather have something different to celebrate their victory. So always trying to do stuff like that. And the Kentucky Downs group there, they're into it. They want to have a little fun with their meet. And so it's a pleasure to work there, and, you know, looking forward to going back in September again.
We love that creativity. You've worked so many different jobs around the racetrack, you know, racing office, racing secretary, these kind of things. But the fact that you also have a marketing brain and the branding awareness about the sport, and you've worked in media, that comes through as well. But what I really want to talk to you about, Hammer, is the process of making, upgrading, downgrading, graded stakes. Tell me how this works. How long have you been involved? Maybe start there.
Okay, well, the American Graded Stake Committee has been around, I think, since the early 70s. I think it's 1973, 74. And it was actually modeled after a European model over there that has what they call pattern races, where, you know, races are pointed in a pyramid type way, where there's, you know, it starts big and then it ends with a race. So they actually were the design of that, and they said, hey, we want you guys to, you know, model, you know, we want you guys to kind of rate your races too. And so the Graded Races Committee was formed, and basically the idea is to grade the races and to give some kind of relative quality, so, you know, the of bloodstock, that we can identify which races are consistently better comparatively around the country. And that way, when some of these races go into the sales books, they mean something. So we obviously, a grade one means more than a grade two, and grade three enlisted, on so on down the line. So our job, the committee, which I'll explain how that is breaks down here in a second, but our job is to rank these races each year. And so with the idea of, you know, the better races getting grade ones and
let me cut in, Rick, right at the top here, and maybe you're planning on getting into this, and I'm jumping the gun. But when we talk about better races, are we talking about metrics like speed figures? Are we talking about what horses have accomplished before they showed up on this day? Are we talking about what horses are going to accomplish after they participated in this race? Or is it a combination of all three?
Well, it's a combination of a lot more things than that. And I will get into that in just a bit. So I wanted to kind of explain how the committee is formed.
Sure.
There's 11 members on the committee. And this is all under the auspices of the Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. So they're of the 11 members, six of them, TOBA is their call letters, T-O-B-A. So of the 11, six are TOBA members, and they're decided, you know, by the TOBA board. They say, okay, these six are in. And then there's five racing officials, which are voted on by the TOBA board. So they select five racing people to be on, and I'm close, but I think we all serve like 3-year terms, and then we can be renewed, and then there are term limits. I think after a couple terms, you have to sit out. You could be asked back, like that. So it is looked after. It's not just some, hey, oh yeah, you're on it for life. It's not that. So we all get together. I mean, the six members right now, the six Toba members or Everett Dobson. I mean, and I'm telling when I mention these people, they're so, you know, like they're titans of the industry. It's really wonderful to be in a room with them. But you know, they're so good to talk to. This group that we have together now, it's really hard to find 11 people that can sit in a room and have discussions, lengthy discussions. And then, you know, when the discussion's over, we move on to something else and it doesn't get personal. So it's great. But Everett Dobson is the chairman right now of Cheyenne Stables. And he's been in the telecommunication business for a while. I think he's a minority owner of the Oklahoma Thunder. He's the chairman. Barbara Bankey, of course, Stone Street and Kendall Jackson Wines, Reynolds Bell, who runs RB Reynolds Bell Thoroughbred Services. You know, family's been in the business for generation after generation. Craig Burnick, who from Glen Hill Farm,
frequent guest on these airways.
You know, has a wealth of knowledge and ideas that comes up with it. Walker Hancock. Who is president? I think he's president of Claiborne Farm at the moment. You know, another generational family involved, and we have a sixth member this year who's now his first meeting. Brant Lau, I believe you pronounce it, and he owns a farm in Kentucky. So he will be at his first meeting this actually next week, to tell you the truth, when we meet. So we'll welcome Brant and the racing officials. Right now are myself, Ben Huffman from Kentucky, you know, Churchill Downs and Keeneland, Tom Robbins from California, Del Mar at the moment, Chris Mers, who's at Santa Anita, and Martin Panza would be the fifth racing official, but since he left New York, when you leave your job, you give up your spot on the committee here. So we will actually, rather than throwing somebody in at the last minute, there will only be four of us racing officials. So only 10 here this year to go over it. And then they'll appoint someone else for that. But so we meet generally three times a year, and we will meet in April. Generally, that's just a kind of a review, any pending business, anybody wants to bring anything up, one of those meetings. We meet in August, right? That's where you see me there at right around sale week. And we talk about a little bit further as we prep for the big meeting, which is coming up here next week in July. And when I say the big meeting, that's when we review the books, we review all the races, we go over everything and decide exactly where the meeting is going to be, when it's going to be, and if there's anything we're going to change. So that's the prep. And then comes the big meeting, which is had been in late November. We've changed it to January to be able to include all the races in the calendar year. And this is the meeting where we literally look at every single graded and listed race run in the country and decide if they belong where they are, if they're in the right spot, if they need to be downgraded, if they're fine where they are, or if there's a chance they can be upgraded. And so we're in the middle right now of getting the information, which the Jockey Club prepares for us. And we get the books, and it's a, like a 50-pound box will show up in the mail here in the next day or two with currently 17 books. And those are all the different categories that we've broken down all the races into, and we'll go book to book. And the categories are pretty obvious, but they've grown over the years. The two-year-olds have been split now into turf and dirt. There was a time when they were just in one book, even the Colts and the Phillies. So now we have two-year-old boys, dirt and turf, two-year-old girls, turf and dirt. And then we have the three-year-olds, route dirt, route turf and sprinting. We have three and up, route, turf, and dirt, and sprinting, and same for the fillies, and same for the three-year-old fillies and the older. And then we've created a whole new category within the last few years, turf sprinting. There, for a long time, the turf sprinters were just lumped in with the dirt sprinters, and we would, you know, figure out which race was on the turf because there wasn't that many of them. Obviously, in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, turf sprinting is become very prominent all over the place. So we've created its own separate category. And since the Breeders' Cup has its own category for that race, we figured we better do it too. So we get 17 of these books, and we have about a week to review them. And then we come in and we sit down at a big board table, and we start with a category, and we start reviewing these races. And you mentioned, okay, well, you know, what do we do? And, you know, we do things, we have five different things, categories we look at. And in general, it would be very similar to if you and I and 10 friends were looking at the racing forum and looking at some charts. I mean, we don't have any secret numbers that nobody else has. We just have, you know, we have all the information that you can get, but it's all in one spot. So we look at 5 years of the history of each race. And we figured that that's a reliable number where, you know, going along, if a race runs a real super race 1 year, you know, it's not going to, it has to show some consistency. That five year will have better numbers and help the overall average, but it's not, 1 year is not going to move you up or down. So rather than just react off of one good or bad race, we spread this out over 5 years. So we have charts of the races. We have what's called NARC ratings. Now, these are ratings. It's the North American Rating Committee, and I think there's four racing people that rate every race, every horse in every graded stake. And from those numbers are attained, each race gets a rating. And so, you know, that might be a number that's, quote, not out there, but it's just like rating that you would see. It's nothing special, but these guys rank the horses. So the top four horses in each graded stake take the average of their number, and that becomes the number of the race. So those get ranked. And obviously, the better the horses that are in there, the higher they get ranked. So we use that. We use percentage of graded stakes in there. Gives us a little bit of something to go on. Then we have a couple of point systems, which are very simple. One of the quality points, which each race gets for each graded stake, each horse that's graded that runs in that stake from 2 years prior to the race and then 2 years from the date of that race forward, you get points. So if you have a grade one winner in your race, you get those quality points up until 2 years later. So that's how very important it is to get those graded race horses in your race, because they stay with your race for a while. Then you also get points for horses that just run in there that are stake winners, that are listed stake winners, or, you know, unlisted stake winners. You get certain points for that. So those numbers come out, and they tell a pretty good story of how the race is doing, how it's been doing. And by having that information in front of you as a guide, kind of places them in some kind of order. And believe me, it was just use the numbers. You wouldn't need us to talk about it. But everyone in that room has something to add, has something to remember about the race. You know, there may be a race that, wow, this race really fell apart. And, you know, maybe that day, oh, they're right, the favorite got sick. Oh, yeah, that's right, he got sick. And, you know, certain things happen. So it's not just a numbers game. It's a discussion on, you know, where the race fits, what the patterns looks like, where it's going. Is the track doing anything to try and make the race better? All this stuff comes into play. And so, you know, a discussion might be held on any number of reasons. And so I'm not saying that we sit and discuss every single race, because many of the races that we look at currently, there's currently 445 graded races, and there's a total of almost 900 races, including the graded races, that are unlisted and listed. So I'm going to say
that's a lot.
It's a lot to look at. And believe me, when you go through the books, you look at them all, and a high majority of them fit right where they are. So as you're going through, you put a little quick check mark, they're good, they're good, they're good, they're good. It's the races that are on the bubble, either up or down, that we'll have discussions about. Yeah.
What percentage races change from year to year? I didn't prep you for that question, but just by feel, what would you say?
It's small. So, I mean, I don't even want to throw out a number that could be wrong. But out of 445 races, I don't know, we can change, 30 of them. I don't know, something like, so a small number. And I might be off by 10 or 20,
Sure.
I don't remember those deep, but not a whole lot. In other words, what needs to be known, we don't go in with a quota, or we don't even talk about anything as long as, we need to cut a bunch this year, or we need to add a bunch this year, or this category is overloaded, or we don't go in with any preconceived ideas. We may individually have stuff that we want to talk about, but as a group, there's no, ganging up, hey, let's all get together and, do this or do that.
I was curious if the foal crop had anything to do with this process. Obviously a lot has been made of the declining foal crop, and I do think there's some logic that your percentage of prestigious races or stakes races or whatever should have some relation to the number of thoroughbreds in total. There's a certain logic to that way of thinking, but it doesn't sound like it works that way at all.
It's brought up in discussion, but it's not like, okay, there's X amount of foals went down, so we got to knock down X amount of races. I think that happens. If it's supposed to happen, it'll happen. It is ironic that when it started back in the 70s, I think there was the first list came out. There were 330 graded stakes. So obviously there were a lot more foals then too. A lot more, racing going on. There's less, but then there's more graded stakes. So it's kind of a weird dynamic how that is. You can't just go in there and say, okay, we're going to take 10 off of here, 10 off of here, 10 off of here. You can't do it that way. So we'll sit down, and as we go through each category, there may be, a dozen races that are worthy of a discussion. Meaning, okay, let's. I'm not even going to mention a race because I don't want to even put any.
I could ask you a very loaded question about upgrading races, given who the sponsor of this podcast is.
Yeah, it's funny because you mentioned that tracks will write letters into us and say, hey, look at this, look at that, look what we've done. We appreciate the letters, we look at it, but we see already. We see beyond the letter. We if you have to write us a letter to tell us to look at your race, then, it's probably not worth looking at. So, understand what I'm saying?
You're tuned in to where the interesting situations and discussions are.
Exactly. And what will happen is if we see a race that may be on the rise, we'll make a note of it to put it on a watch list for next year, which means that we have to talk about it, either going up or going down. Like, hey, this race looks like it's headed the wrong direction. Let's see if they, are trying to rescue it or they really don't care. So tracks will try to change the date, maybe a distance, try and do something to make their race better. That's another thing that comes into play. Sometimes races are unsalvageable no matter what you do. And sometimes races are just headed for right up that ladder. And you see that stuff and they get rewarded. I want to tell a funny story that when we have the meeting, we're going to meet in Lexington next week, the 25th, 26th, something like that. And at these meetings, at the discretion of the TOBA committee, we have observers. And so we can have anywhere from 5 to 10 observers, industry leaders or whoever they decide that wants to sit in. And so we'll sit there, and they're in the room with us. They're not allowed to enter into any discussion, but they're in the room and they watch the process. And believe me, they probably don't want to come back because it's a pretty long, boring process. But it's wonderful that we have them there just to say, hey, watch us. We're not doing anything funny. We're not doing hey, let's do this, let's do that. And so one year we had someone from a track, and one of their races got moved up. And I think it was to a grade one, and the meeting ends, and of course say, hey, don't say anything. They come out with a formal press release. Well, next, I think it was that night, it was like headlines on one of the websites. It was like, oh boy. And it's funny because we all knew who might have leaked it, and they got scolded a little bit, but it was pretty funny. So we try to we try to keep it down until we can formally write the track a letter and, you know, do all that stuff. Because I always, the meeting ends on Thursdays and I'm always on Steve's show on Friday. And I'm always waiting, you know, I have to call in. Is the release out yet? Can I say anything? Nope. So I can never even say anything the next day until, you know, it's after Steve's off the air. It's pretty funny. But I remember that night. It's like people calling around. Did you say anything? No. Did you? Have you seen the site? Over? Oh, my gosh. There it is all over. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but it's pretty funny. But we do, like I said, we're not hiding in a vacuum. We have observers. And honestly, any track, you know, executive that says, hey, I'd like to check it out, call Dan Metzger at Tatova and say, hey, can I be an observer? I mean, he's going to probably say, sure. Come on down.
So, a question for the uninitiated.
Yes.
Explain why it's such a big deal for a track to, for example, get a race upgraded to a grade one.
Well, you know, the grade ones, there's currently 100 grade ones total out of the mix. You know, grade one races attract grade one horses, and let's not kid ourselves. And you know, racetracks still you know run. They want the best horses to come to their races, and they want people to come, and they want people to bet on them. And so getting those horses there, you know, getting the owners there, getting the whole deal and the hoopla around having a great grade one race means a whole lot. And so doing what you can to get there. And I'll tell you, there's a lot. Once you get to that spot, you can really see the difference over the years, you know, when it's a grade one. And many times when you get downgraded from a grade one to a grade two, the race goes off into oblivion. It just loses its pizzazz and it just, you know, kind of falls off the map, almost like people looking for somewhere else to run. Every once in a while, you'll see a race rebound from back to grade two. They say, hey, you know what, maybe we were doing something wrong. And they you know, kind of hold a little momentum and head back in the other direction. Which happens, and you know that's noted, and it's we do it. So it's an honor to be a grade one, and so we, you know, think hard both ways. Think hard of, you know, does this race deserve it of it? Yes, it is. Okay, let's do it. And on the other hand, you know, it's tough to take them away, but you know what? If the race does not deserve to be a grade one, you know, we're not afraid to pull that from them. And, you know, many times it's, you know, it's a tough thing to do. But like I said, with this group, and I've been involved on and off, I don't know, 10, 15 years. Early on, when I was an observer many years ago, the committee was a one day thing and things happened here and there and whatever. I don't know. Backroom seemed like there was some backroom deals going on, but I'll tell you what, since I've been back on, asked to come back on, the people on there are so into it and so involved and really, you know, pour their hearts into it that when you're done, everything that happened might not have been, you know, the way you thought it was going to happen or should have happened, but you walk out of that room going, you know what, we did the right thing. And so, I mean, that's all you can ask for in this. And that's why I say this, these 11 people, or actually 10 this year, and 9 others, I really appreciate being able to work with them and know that you gave your honest effort and did the right thing.
How does it work when you're associated with a track like you are, especially a track like Kentucky Downs that, you know, I imagine the committee is going to be looking at? Are you expected to lobby for your track? Is the expectation more that you're meant to be impartial and just looking at the data? And, you know, this isn't just a question for you, but for the other people who are associated with racetracks who are on the committee, like how does that piece of it work?
Well, so the five racing people it's very geographical. Usually, traditionally, it's been a couple from California because they had, you know, a big amount of races. New York at least had one, and then it was some Midwest. So basically, I don't represent Kentucky Downs. I don't represent Oaklawn. I mean, I probably represent the Midwest region more so than others. And when I say represent, more in tune with what's going on here, say, than maybe other places, where really, in reality, all of us watch races from all over the place. So sure. No. And what's interesting, when we take a vote, when we say, hey, we're gonna, you know, talk about the blue boat stakes over here, And we've decided that we want to vote on this race to see if it's we not somebody literally say, I vote that we upgrade the Blue Boat Stakes to a grade two. We say, okay, call for a vote. So whenever we call for a vote, everybody votes. It takes X amount. I think it's I don't I'm gonna give the wrong number, but there's X amount over a majority to move it up or to move it down. So we all vote. We have our own little color cards that we put yes or no. It's very, you know, simple. We put them in the envelope. So nobody knows who we vote, but the votes are kept over here. So in other words, if you know, I'm working for, you know, Kentucky Downs, or let's say when I work for Santa Anita, I'm voting yes on every Santa Anita race and no on every other race. I mean, it's going to be shown and it's going to be, hey, you can't do that. No. So there really isn't there. You're not a cheerleader for your track. The only thing is they might look to you to, you know, give a reason why something's happening to a race in your region, which you may more know about than anybody else. But other than that, you know, you can look over the years, you can see that really there's no favoritism in there. It just, and when you go in, you don't know how the meeting's going to go. Meaning, you know, sometimes you walk in there thinking it's going to, you know, it's not going to be a whole lot of changes, and wow, you know, look at all these races that were brought up and got changed. And sometimes you think it's going to be, you know, like a bloodbath where a lot of races get downgraded, and it's not, because, you know, sense is talking into both sides, and you go, you know what, that guy's right. You know, you're right. Maybe it is okay, or maybe we should upgrade, or maybe we should downgrade. So, a lot of respect given to everybody that speaks in there. And when a vote is called for, we vote, and it's not like it's over. Oh, it's not. There's no whining in the room. We have the vote. It's tallied. The race goes up or down or stays the same, and we move on to the next race. And there's no like, you know, hey, let's go back and do that race that we did again, you know, the next day, anytime, anything like that. Whatever's done at the end of that day, it's done. And then we move on to the next day and finish up. So just a super fair process. And like I said, with the observers there too, you can have, you know, pick out an observer that's watched over the last 5-10 years, and, you know, they're going to say, yeah, you know, I got to admit, these guys do a pretty good job in there. So I'm very proud to be working with these people. I'm proud to walk out there with my head held high going, you know what? We did a good job.
That's very cool. I wanted to ask specifically about speed figures. And you mentioned a little bit about the role they play in the process. And you mentioned how this process is derived from the sort of English pattern race process, where, of course, it's a little bit different. They have official form ratings. Every horse has like an industry accepted rating. I guess the buyer speed figure is the closest thing we have to that, but it's not at all the same as the way that it works in England. What figures are people looking at? Are they looking at a variety of figures? What figures do you care about insofar as this process goes? I want to hear a little bit about
that.
Okay,
so we have, like I told you, we have those NARC ratings, which rank the races numerically. And that's something that we look at that is not generally out there. So because it's made by racing guys, I think not everyone on the committee, not everybody, I'm not on the NARC committee. So there's a couple people that are on and a couple people that aren't, but we respect those numbers. They really refined them over the years. We're offered Thoroughgraph numbers as well. Although I'm a big fan of Thoroughgraph, I tend to not look at them in this situation. It blow my mind. I mean, it's just too many things. I've gotten so used to the way the information is given to us in the little chart ways they do it, the points that are added up, you know, the quality points. And then we'll literally go over and, you know, look at each horse in the race and go, yeah, this horse, that was good. Oh, that was a good running there. We know that this horse might not be a grade one winner now, but he was second last time, and he looks like he's going to help this race in the future. And so everybody in there, you know, does their homework. We got our laptops there if we need to look up a runner that we maybe not be familiar with, but you know, just the nuts and bolts, nothing fancy. You know, when I say figure wise, and didn't want to make it a point that we don't get too caught up in the numbers.
You have proprietary numbers that you're looking at, and it does seem more. It really is the USA equivalent of like the British system and the form ratings. I have a feeling the way you're describing those NARC ratings back when we were in high school, a narc rating meant something else, by the way. But when you're
looking at the word, the word narc meant something else.
It does feel like it's giving you a way of just trying to evaluate the overall form of the race in terms of the before, during, and after. And, you know, I know you guys are going to have some interesting discussions next week. We'll, now when we hear the results of it, we're all much better edified, and we appreciate that. And who knows? I'm not going to, obviously, don't want to get into conflict of interest stuff here, but I would imagine, just from my own experience as a horse player and now hearing how the process works, there may just be some good news for our sponsors coming out of this graded stakes process this year. Rick, thank you so much for taking time to join. Anything else you want to say before we let you get out of here and move on to our next guest?
No, I think we're good, and I really appreciate being able to let people know how this is. It's not a magic ball. Just good old hard work, and we leave the room and hope we did the right thing. And it doesn't always please everyone, but that's not what we're there for. And so I appreciate the opportunity to let people know about this with you, Pete. And, you know, that's why your show is so good. And I want to congratulate you officially on air for winning the Eclipse Award this year. Well deserved.
Well, you're very kind. We appreciate it. A lot of hard work and, you know, putting the microphone in front of the right people to hear their interesting stories, something I feel like we were able to accomplish with you today. Appreciate it. Hope we get to see each other soon. I know there's a lot of balls in the air. Don't exactly know when that will be, but hopefully it will be sooner rather than later. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Peter. See you down the road.
Next up on the show, very happy to welcome to the show somebody who is involved in the business in a variety of ways, working with the Tote over in the UK, but also on the ownership side. And he's got some experience racing horses internationally at Kentucky Downs. Alex Frost, welcome to the In the Money Airwaves.
Thanks very much, Pete. Real pleasure to chat to you.
Very happy to have you here and want to hear about your experience professionally and on the ownership side. But let's start out talking about your experience at Kentucky Downs. I would imagine we might be seeing more and more cross-pollination in the coming years, given the purse structure at Kentucky Downs and the configuration, which might lend itself to being favorable to runners coming from overseas. How was your experience running there in 2021?
Yeah, no, it was a crazy journey, really. We had a very nice filly over here who really needed fast ground. So we sent her over to the States. She's called La Lune. She won the Nottinghamshire Oaks and she won the Pinnacle. So she had won two decent races over here. She then ran in the Lancashire Oaks and it rained, as it sometimes does over here.
Once in a while.
for 24 hours solid, and went from fast ground to heavy ground. And she got stuck in the mud. But she's a very smart filly, and so we brought her over, and Ed Vaughan trained her for the race. She ran in the Kentucky Downs Ladies Marathon. And listen, it was a crazy race where she got no sort of run, but she snuck up the rail and was only beaten by a horse called Brendan Walsh. It's called Family Way, but she was beaten a neck. But listen, it was a brilliant experience for us, and we were just very sad not to be able to get over for it with all that's going on at the moment.
Well, maybe in future it'll be an opportunity to make the trip. I would imagine that would only make it all the more special. But still, it's got to be great to be able to have the opportunity to compete internationally in an exciting race meeting, and by the way, for a pretty healthy purse as well.
Yeah, and coming from a Tote perspective, we were intrigued by how the purse was managed and how they got to those levels of prize money. Obviously, there's a local Kentucky boost to the prize, but crucially, seeing how the pool can drive really good prize money in a very contained and orchestrated way, I thought was fabulous and a great template for the industry and something we're striving to do with the Tote in the UK.
I was going to ask you to bring in your quote unquote day job. I do want to talk to you more on the ownership side, but yeah, what you must think with the challenge that you're facing in this culture of betting over in the UK that traditionally is bookmaker driven, where I'm just going to go ahead and say it, the horsemen maybe don't always get the cut that is commensurate with the amount of commitment and work that they put in working to build a robust tote that will benefit the industry at large. I mean, what do you think when you see how differently it goes on over here, and what strides can potentially be taken to make a more robust tote in the UK?
Yeah, look, I mean, we look on with envy, if I'm being totally honest. You know, seeing you guys break $1 billion in prize money last year certainly sort of was a jaw-dropping moment for us. I think, you know, the industry, while it's, you know, it's got many parts in so many states and complexity, you know, the overall ethos of pools driving prize money is very straightforward but hugely effective. That can really happen over here. You know, international sport is internationally bet on, and international pools is what World Pool's all about. And I think that is a seriously exciting progression and something we're really striving towards over here. But it's great to see what's going on over there, and you're getting tons of horses come over from Europe now and really drive the quality of racing. And, you know, a lot of staying out there. We sent a filly called Queen of Time, who was 7 times black type placed over as well the year before. She sadly got injured, but, you know, we're going to be doing lots more of that, because I think it's great for the international nature of the sport.
I love to see all that cross-pollination, and we're seeing it more and more. And one thing that I know is exciting to me from a punter's point of view, and this gets back to your day job. I sort of undersold it before. I think I said you work for the tote. You're the CEO. And this idea of the world pool days on the tote, where the liquidity we're seeing is the kind of thing that I think should be capturing the attention of interested punters worldwide, and showing that the tote really is a viable and interesting option, and something that I would say, especially with all this cross-pollination and horses shipping over for the Breeders' Cup and big events like that, something that punters should be paying more attention to. What do you have planned in terms of the world pool days for the 2022 racing calendar?
Yeah, so the way it works is Hong Kong have 85 days of their own racing between Happy Valley and Sha Tin. They then have a further 37 international days, which they brought simulcast into Hong Kong, and they bet into via the Hong Kong pool. 17 of those days last year went to the areas we run as totes, UK and Ireland. And they were, you know, a huge, huge success. You know, that was up from, I think we had 6 days in 2020. So 17 in last year. And, you know, you saw huge global interest in those events. And really, the more we can drive that, the better. And, you know, you've got 20 countries playing into the Hong Kong pool for each of those World Pool days. So it's Royal Ascot, Glorious Goodwood, York, the Guineas, the Derby, and hopefully maybe the Oaks this year. It's a seriously exciting project that covers, you know, it goes the other 20 odd days go to South Africa, Australia, and so on. So look, and Dubai is coming up soon. So there's a huge amount going on. But, you know, we had £25 million worth of liquidity traded on each of those days. So you can see the effect, and the underlying sport benefits accordingly.
And I'll point out to some of the folks listening who get rebates on their play through the tote in the USA that you're looking to get pretty hefty rebates on those days as well. So when you combine that opportunity to get money back from your ADW with that kind of liquidity, these are big opportunities. And again, you can hear from the dates that Alex rattled off there. Not coincidentally, a lot of these meetings, Glorious Goodwood, York, Royal Ascot, you're going to be seeing horses that are going to be turning up here later in the year. So it's something that I definitely want to pay more attention to on the network throughout the course of this year. I mean, I think we did some pretty solid international coverage in 2021, but it definitely is one of my initiatives for 2022 to shine more of a light on this terrific product and keep fans interested and wagering when it comes to the international product, I think that everybody can benefit. So it sounds like the calendar is going to be pretty similar in 2022 to what it was in 2021.
Right. And you know, the international flavor is there for all to see. I mean, you guys have been fabulous at supporting the likes of Royal Ascot. I think, you know, it was 20 odd horses came over last year. And the rebates you refer to there, we've ingrained them in the pricing structure we have over here. And I think other totes will start to really do that as well, and ADWs. You know, we got customers playing for 6%, basically. So if you think starting price over here is somewhere sort of around double that, you can really see how it's a very, very attractive proposition for punters. And I think that's, you know, we've got to be mega competitive, you know, with the fixed odds operators. We want to provide a genuine alternative to make it interesting for all customers. But, you know, and the fact that, the lot of these funds that are driven out, as you saw with Kentucky Downs, going straight back into the sport, I think it makes for a much more sustainable model going forward.
Here's a difficult question that I didn't prep you for. And it's just sort of interesting because of where we are now in the sports betting culture and in the horse racing betting culture in the United States. We've got the advent of fixed odds betting. It's happening right now in this country. I am of the belief that, especially with the way that fixed odds is being implemented, where the exotics wagering is still going to be happening, not booked by bookies, but through the tote system, with the fixed odds out there to help lure in so many of the sports bettors, and there's many more sports bettors in the USA than there are horse bettors, fixed odds being used to bring those people, showcase our sport to them, with then exotic betting still happening on the tote. I'm of the belief that fixed odds betting is only going to help and fortify the existing tote betting in the USA. But, you know, you're coming from a very different culture. And I wonder if, as I'm saying this, if it sounds a little maybe too blue sky as a tote person, do you think my view that the fixed odds betting in the US can help tote betting is realistic? Do you think it's something tote betting operators in the US need to be a little bit wary of? I'm just curious for a truly objective perspective on this betting culture that's changing by the minute here in the USA.
Yeah, I mean, look, we have 90-95% market share in fixed odds. So we and it's interesting to have seen so many of the deals done in the States have involved UK companies. So that we're not very good at much in the UK, but I think fixed odds and bookmaking probably is something that we've kind of been brought up with. And it's a great product. You know, it's incredibly competitive. The margins that customers get over here is unreal. You know, as a customer, you have 150 odd operators all competing for your business. And I guess you're seeing that in the promotional offers in the States at the moment. From the fixed odds operators. So, you know, you can see it's a big battle between them all to win your business. And once you get entrenched and set up with a bookmaker, you know, it's pretty sticky. So people, you know, the cost of acquisition is very high in the States, and that's why. But I think in terms of, you know, how it benefits the sport, I think the two should sit very much hand in hand. I totally take your point that exotics are much more in keeping with the risk profile of a tote, and you know, totes are better naturally at running that, and totes have massive advantage. You know, you don't need customers to lose for you to win. You don't need to run risk books. I mean, my banking background, you know, we used to run big risk portfolios. I've worked for big American banks like Merrill Lynch, and you know, it is a very tough game running a risk book versus a low margin tote. But I do stress low margin totes. If totes sit there and they try and take too much out of customers, that is a race to the bottom. And I think that's what I would encourage the US totes to do, is to be much, much more considerate to customers when it comes to, you know, you hear a lot of rebates, but why the need for rebates? Why not start at a lower margin from the outset and make sure all customers get a decent deal, which is what we've done over here. You know, customers now trading at 6%. It was 20%. You know, you either
move
now, or it's, you're going to have problems further down the line.
that's music to horse players' ears, because while I've been a believer in rebate as a almost like a necessary evil, I would say, in that they do run the risk of driving out new customers who aren't competing on a level playing field with the best customers who are also getting the best rebates, this idea that you just put forth that making it just essentially lowering the takeout for everybody. I mean, to me, the rebate in the States came about as a de facto way to lower the takeout for your best customers. But the idea you're putting forth of lowering that takeout for everybody, it just feels like a healthier ecosystem that's not going to grind out the new customers and lets people hang around longer and basically creates a market where you just have more people playing in it, and it doesn't become the way the tote markets are sort of trending in the US, where it's just shark against shark.
Yeah.
It is what I'm describing, the exactly what you're talking about as well?
100%. I mean, I think, you know, the US is very akin with financial markets. And with financial markets, people, no matter what their volume contribution was, as long as they're an active player, they got a fair deal. And I think, you know, lots of professionals will you know, shout at the podcast right now, I'm sure, to say that they should get a volume discount. But I think they also need to be very, very aware. You need to have a sustainable ecosystem. You need to have, you know, as many people as possible playing at a consistent and fair level. To your point, you know, it's got to be, you know, it's difficult to grade people as to what volume contribution they give. And I don't think that model is proven to be working in any jurisdiction, really. And I think where you get, you know, low margin, high liquidity, you know, as you've seen with ATG in Sweden, it's been a huge positive effect that a 10% takeout, flat 10% takeout's had over there. You're seeing built-in rebates in Hong Kong now, you know, of I think it's 12p in the pound, 12 cents for losing bets over 10,000 Hong Kong dollars. So that is built into the system as well, i.e. you're playing for a much lower margin. And that is just very much kind of much more in keeping with where the retail customer, I think, should sit in the pecking order.
It's a fascinating rabbit hole that we could easily do an entire podcast on, but I do want to bring it back in the few moments we have left to the horse ownership side of things. When did you first get involved owning horses? What came first for you, a passion for racing or working in the business?
Yeah, no, I've been, you know, mad keen on horses. My granddad won the Sussex Stakes in 1964 over here. So yeah, over 50 years ago. And we, as a family, have always been mad keen on a very, very small scale. We never got anywhere near those heights. But I've also had lots of friends I've done it with. We've got a couple of horses. We're aiming for Cheltenham this year. We won the Acomb at York, and we're still talking about that. It's from 2013 and still recovering from the hangover as well. But no, it's a wonderful game, and I just feel hugely blessed to be involved. It's been a great passion. And I've met brilliant people along the way. It's there's nothing that will beat the roar as the you know, the Supreme starts in what, 5 weeks' time at Cheltenham. You know, there's lots of fun to be had, isn't there?
And when you made the transition from owning horses to then working in the industry, what went into that decision?
A lack of thought, I think.
It's always dangerous. I always say this. It's always dangerous when you turn avocation into vocation. Yeah,
my dad said you should never do it, and I think he's probably right. But no, I've done 20 years of banking on a trading floor. As I said, 10 years for Merrill Lynch, 10 years for Climate Benson, and 20 years on a trading floor is a long time. But then I, aged 40, when I wanted to do something different, and I just looked at the tote, and I just didn't see how racing in the UK and Ireland could survive without a good tote. So look, we're 3 years into the journey, and I hope that the tote now, we start off with circa sort of 12 employees. We now have 170. We have a really, really good proposition. We just need to tell people about it. So we need people like yourself advocating, you know, what I think is a really, really good proposition to people now. You know, you can get on in 20 grand at SP, we have SP guarantee over here as well as the low margin. So,
I mean, that's amazing. I do agree that's at least in the U.S. Maybe those opportunities aren't available in the U.S., but even in the U.K., where obviously I spend in non-pandemic times plenty of time, I'm not sure that that's like fully ingrained in the consciousness what a good deal that is.
No, and we just got to get the proposition, you know, good across the board. You know, what we didn't have before was SP guarantee on course, which we've done that. You know, you'll get that at Cheltenham this year. You get text betting, you know, you've got £1 million play spots. You know, it's all this stuff that, you know, we've done a very bad job, if I'm being honest, in getting the message out there. And frankly, we've only just had these changes implemented. So, you know, we are, you know, at our very nascent form, but, you know, you should see these pools really get going now. And I think Whirlpool and the Hong Kong Jockey Club have been utterly brilliant to work with. You've got great operators out in the States, you know, they're business people who want to get on with it. And, you know, I think the totes and fixed odds should sit, you know, hand in hand. There's lots they can do in partnership together. We just need to make the sport as attractive as possible and make sure that, you know, you get these big races as well marketed around the world as possible. And there's this huge fallacy that betting operators need massive fields and massive amounts of product. I think what everybody is saying to me and what we're seeing in our own numbers is, you know, quality, deep fields that are competitive, that have good spacing between them, that are well marketed and well broadcast. And, you know, we have people like yourself to spread the word of what's a wonderful sport.
I think that's very well said, and something we'll perhaps talk about off air as well, because it's a mission that I definitely believe in. And I think a lot of people in our audience, which is, you know, primarily US based, but also spread around the world, would be interested in learning more about as well. I'll bring it back to the sponsor of this podcast for our last question, just proving that I know where my bread is buttered. The experience of running a horse at Kentucky Downs for an international owner. Overall, something positive, something you'd be looking to do again?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, the prize money was phenomenal. We would love to come over and really enjoy it. I mean, Kentucky's an incredible place. And, you know, I just think that the more international flavor you can get in these fields and the more global coverage you can get, it presents really, really exciting opportunities. But crikey, you know, seeing that prize money, seeing those fantastic fields, you know, they've done some jobs so far. So huge accolades. And just feel sore that we didn't get up on the line, but we'll be back next year for sure.
No, that's what we like to hear, and we'll see what strings we can pull behind the scenes so we can get some Kentucky Downs on the TV in the UK. You know, we know some people over there at Sky. Maybe we can make this happen.
Yeah, for sure. And look, we would love, as the tote, we would love to work with the Kentucky Downs team. So that's a very open offer. We would love to co-mingle that fixture. It'd be phenomenal.
Great stuff. Alex Ross, the CEO of the Tote, a horse owner in his own right, obviously passionate about this game. Great having you on, and I say we do it again soon.
Look forward to it. Brilliant. Take care.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. I'd like to thank Alex Frost and Rick Hammerly one more time. We'll thank our sponsors over at Kentucky Downs as well. Our founding partners, 10 Strike Racing. You know how over here we always love to root for the purple and black, and the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, doing amazing work through their Second Chances program. You've heard about them plenty on these airwaves. We encourage you to give and help the cause. And hey, we even have some promotional gift type items for you. A couple bottles of whiskey left if you want to check that out. trfinc.org/players. Most of all, though, we want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. Reach out, hit me up on Twitter at LoomsBoldly or over on the contact page at InTheMoneyPodcast.com. Sign up for our free newsletter while you're over there, InTheMoneyPodcast.com/email. This has been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornatale. May you win all your photos!